Welcome to News Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Now you've heard the story of Frankie Silver, the mountain woman who drove an axe into her husband, Charlie, back in 1831, and you'd think people would have forgotten about it by now. But the legend keeps going on and on. And you'd have to say that part of the reason that we keep talking about it is a Chapel Hill historian, author, activist, playwright, Perry Dean Young keeps talking about it and writing about it and writing books about it. And all of that has resulted in a new Discovery Channel program that will tell the story of Frankie Silver. Really, thanks. I don't think you would. Perry Dean, if it hadn't been for you, they wouldn't have done this, would it? I mean, these people wouldn't have done the television program.
Well, I like to think so, but probably they just find somebody else to tell a different story. But the part
tell
of the story—
Who's doing this television program?
It's being done by Beyond Television out of Australia, which does a number of the series on the Discovery Channel.
So it's not just going to be on Australian television. It's
No. It'll be broadcast January 25th, I think, at 9 p.m. in America. That'll be the first broadcast.
And then, it'll be over and over and over again.
I mean,
we'll see this over and over again. Well, let's go back to the very beginning. Let's go back to 1831. Tell us what happened.
Well, let's go back to your introduction of this. You kind of laughed, and that's sort of the way I was brought up on this story.
I'm laughing about the story.
Yeah, you're about that an axe going in somebody's head. You sort of
it is.
It's sort of a horrible story, and you can it's like gallows humor. You can only laugh about it. But the way I grew up, it was that the evil Frankie chopped her husband's head off and then burned him in the fireplace. That's the way I heard it.
You heard it in school? You heard it around the table?
I heard it from my mother. I heard it in school. And my mother was very supportive, very encouraging. Anything I wanted to do, she would encourage it.
How did they tell you the story? Can you remember the first time you heard it? Was it just laughing like I was, or was it, this was a terrible thing that happened up here?
Yeah, I want to get back to this laughter later, but the point was that by then she had become a cartoon, a kind of caricature. And everybody up there thought that she was the basis, that this murder was the basis of Frankie and Johnny.
Yeah.
Had no connection whatsoever. Although there was a ballad written at the time of the hanging by a schoolteacher in Morganton called Frankie Silver's Confession. But that had no connection to Frankie and Johnny. But the story, I guess because Frankie and Johnny is so embedded in our minds.
Yeah.
Of the wife getting her revenge because of a jealousy. That's how the Frankie Silver story came down, sort of like a cartoon figure, a caricature. And I wrote my first Frankie Silver story when I was in high school. I was 16 years old, wrote it as a theme in one of my English classes. Then I got to the university, and I inherited a bunch of papers, and one of them was from a man everybody always had said was the lawyer for Frankie Silver, but there was nothing in there that said Frankie Silver. And I was talking to Dr. James Patton, who was head of the Southern Historical Collection at that time, and he thought it was just delightful that a kid 18 years old would have these papers going back to 1700s. And I gave them to the Southern Historical Collection, and they're still there, by the way. But he also said, I said, there's nothing in here about Frankie Silver. And I've always been, he said, well, maybe if you try the governor's papers over in Raleigh. And I went to the governor's papers, and amazingly, there were 17 letters, documents, letters and petitions on Frankie's behalf. 200 or 300 people signed petitions to save her from the gallows. She was in jail for 15 months, which was very unusual back then. You either got hanged or you got branded and got released. There were no such things as prisons. And in those letters and petitions, it came out that she had an abusive husband. One of the women's petitions, which again, an extremely unusual document because women couldn't vote, couldn't serve on juries, couldn't do much of anything. But they were so moved by this Frankie Silver story, they wrote a petition to Governor Swain and said that he beat her at a time when female delicacy would most forbid it. And I'm hoping that line will get through to the Discovery Channel. But the point was, suddenly, this was a very vulnerable human being. She was not a laughingstock. She was not a cartoon character anymore to me. She was a real human
abused human being.
Well,
Perry Dean, do this for me. I don't want to interrupt your line of thinking on this, but tell us the outline of what happened, and as best we can know. And if there's some things that we don't know, to tell us about. But you jumped me for smiling when I said that she axed her husband.
Yeah,
but she did. She did. She
in 1831, 2 days before Christmas, 1831, she went over to her in-law's house and said that her husband had gone off hunting, either that or had gone to George Young's to get his Christmas whiskey, and he hadn't come back, and she was awful worried about him. Well, 2 weeks went by, and they started searching around the place. And they started finding, like, in the fireplace, they found all these bones that didn't look like animal bones, you know, didn't look like pig bones or goat bones or anything that they would have cooked in the fireplace. And then eventually they found his skull out back in a hollow log or a tree stump. And so then coroner, an inquest was called, and I think at the house itself. I'm not sure. It doesn't say on the document whether it was at the house itself. And she and her mother and her brother were all arrested. The mother and brother were arrested for helping to dispose of the body. And what obviously happened, she was a poor, simple woman who had done this horrible thing in a moment of passion to save her life. And she and her family thought that she could get rid of the evidence and maybe she'd be all right. And at that time, if you were accused of a crime, you could not testify in your own defense. In 1859, the law was changed to what it is now. If you choose to, you can take the stand, but you can't be compelled. You still cannot be compelled to testify against yourself. But she was never allowed to go on the stand and say, he was trying to kill me, and I killed him. And that's the part of the story that's always been missing. But in these documents, which I found, they referred time and again to the confession Mrs. Silver wrote. And we've never found the original confession, but we have all these other, these secondary documents which refer to it. And all of them say he was loading his gun to kill her, and she picked up an axe, and I guess her aim was better. And there I go making a joke of it, too.
You're not supposed to laugh at this.
Yes.
but that's gallows-type humor.
Yeah.
I mean, but it is.
Well,
it's
so horrible, you have to make a joke of it.
Yeah, you have to laugh at it. So,
but the turning point for me was when I realized, hey, she wasn't the spiteful Frankie getting her revenge because her man done her wrong or anything. She was just a poor, simple woman who tried to defend herself and then didn't know what to do. You know?
Well, is there other evidence that she was defending herself? I mean, because this is pretty that the evidence that she chopped up the body and burned it, and I mean that leans the other way that she thought she'd really done something really terrible that she was going to conceal.
Well, it's what would the lawyer say? That goes evidence of motive, you know, that she knew she was guilty,
yeah.
So she's trying to get rid of the evidence. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I also wrote a play about this, and in the play we go into elaborate detail on the legal complications, and the gruesome way. But what stuck in everybody's mind was the gruesome way she got rid of the evidence. You know, and would that have figured in a trial? I guess it would have. So I don't know. If you notice my book, the subtitle is "Was She Unjustly Hanged?" Question mark. And I guess that question mark will always be there because there were only two of them in the cabin when he was killed. And my point is, how many other murders up there do we not know about? I mean, when you think how hard those people lived in those tiny little cabins with no windows and no air conditioner in the summer, and only the heat from the fireplace in the winter, which was a lot, by the way. But you know, it had cabin fever was a very real thing, and I'm sure there are hundreds that we don't know about. But this one struck a chord because of the way she disposed of the body.
Well, we're visiting with our neighbor and friend, Perry Dean Young, about Frankie Silver. And we're not going to laugh when we say this, but she was accused and convicted of murdering her husband. And we're going to talk some more about it after this short break. Back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Our neighbor and friend, Perry Dean Young, he's author, playwright, historian, and used to be in the early days, he would be a provocateur. He would stir things up a little bit, but gosh, you're just...
I've calmed down a little bit in my old age.
You and I are aging gracefully.
I still get as angry. I just don't talk about it as much.
But we're talking about this mountain story that has been a part of your life, Frankie Silver, the mountain woman who was convicted and hanged for the murder of her husband. What, Perry Dean, what other than your writing, your book and plays about this, what is it that keeps this story alive? It's 1831. It's 180 years ago.
Yeah. Well, it's a fascinating story. I mean, two things. One, it's the story of a woman who fought back. And that's interesting in itself, at a time when women had no rights at all. You know, a married woman couldn't even hold property. You know, couldn't vote, couldn't serve on a jury. And the other thing is the way she disposed of the body by burning it in the fireplace. That's pretty gruesome. You know, I always say most people's mothers tell them about Winnie the Pooh and Tigger the Tiger. My mother told me about a woman who cut her husband's head off and burned him in the fireplace.
Your mother told you that story the whole time?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And I've always been grateful for that. You know, I'm a writer after all.
I know, of course, but I wanted to ask you this earlier. Can you recreate your mama's voice, the story that she told you?
Oh, if I could recreate my mama's voice, I'd be a great writer. Unfortunately, I can't. But one way they tell it, this was told, and a Yankee woman came into Yancey County in Mitchell County and wrote a book called Cabins in the Laurels in 1935, Muriel Early Shepherd. And she tells it in a kind of rhyme thing that I never heard of, frankly. But she says, there was, and the way I've referred to it, there was a time when bacon fat are frying in the skillet would set the old folks to talking about the way poor old Charlie Silver went on. Wasn't that maybe how he smelled and sounded when she was burning them bit by bit? And then she goes on and on about the evil Frankie's, you know, conniving to wait until he's asleep, gets him to chop up a bunch of wood, you know, and then he's laid down with the baby in his arms on a sheepskin rug and goes to sleep. She sneaks the baby out and then chops his head off in a revenge. But she didn't kill him immediately. He gets up and thrashes around the room and said, "God save the child." And so then she hides under the bed until he falls down, and then she chops again and chops his head completely off. And then she stays up all night long and burning the body in the fireplace, getting rid of the evidence. But then she scrubs the place, the puncheon floor and everything, scrubs it down and goes over and brags to her in-laws that Charlie's been gone and she doesn't know what's happened to him, but she's been up since dawn scrubbing her floors and doing all this stuff. Well, under the puncheon floors, they found all this blood, you know, and they found bones in the fireplace, and eventually... The most important thing they found from a factual standpoint was his iron boot heel. And they had a blacksmith from Morganton testified that he made the boot heel and it was...
Yeah, otherwise no DNA or anything like that. A bone's a bone.
Yeah. They did produce the axe, I think, because in the indictment, the axe is described in elaborate detail, and the wound to his head is described in elaborate detail.
The story that you told us that the outsider had written in verse and had all of the background about how Frankie slipped up on her husband, got him to, you know, tricked him into going to sleep and all that. Was that conjecture? Is that part of every story or is?
Yes, yes. If you go into any newspaper morgue, and do they still call them morgues?
Morgues, uh-huh.
If you go into any new clip file in any newspaper in North Carolina, you'll find the same story. She was the first or only white woman ever hanged in North Carolina. Well, she wasn't even the first in Burke County. She was at least the third in Burke County, and she was one of 15 hanged in North Carolina. And I'll never forget, you know, these people who work in archives are really quite wonderful. And I was working, when I discovered those papers, I was sitting there and I said, you know, she was the first woman ever hanged in North Carolina. And the guy looked at me and he said, oh, for God's sake. He said, the first person hanged in North Carolina was a woman. She was not the first woman hanged in North Carolina. And he proceeded to show me how many others had been hanged, you know. But the interesting thing, in the play which we did, I'm my mother's son. My mother was a feminist before her time. We showed how the rights of women at that time were just non-existent. At the very same time Frankie was brought to trial, a man in Morganton beat his wife to death with a ramrod. Now, that's very important because you know the rule of thumb. You could beat your wife so long as the rod wasn't bigger than your thumb, and a ramrod is not bigger than your thumb. And he beat her to death, and he was punished with court costs. And he went on off to, if you go on the internet, you can find his name. He went off to Arkansas or someplace and had another wife and another family, you know. And he was never punished a day in jail.
Well, are you taking the position in your book and your play and just in that Frankie was justified in chopping her husband up?
Yes.
And how can you do that? Just because he was abusive?
What do you mean, just because he was abusive?
Yeah,
that's the reason enough, as far as I'm concerned.
For a wife to kill a husband.
Well, he's trying to kill her. No, it wasn't just that he was abusive, that he had been abusive for a long time. Well, the Fayetteville Observer published a story 2 weeks after she was hanged and described the husband as absolutely worthless and said after she had done it, she said, would to God that I could recall this. I would do it. But it was a moment of passion. I mean, you know, he was trying to kill her. No, she killed him in self-defense. In the 1800s, I promise you, I mean, you know, stealing a horse was the worst thing you could do.
But in the version you told me that this woman had written, she tricked him into working hard and going to sleep, and then while he was lying there in the bed, she took the first. That's the imagination of the author rather than the facts.
No, that's just the way the story's been handed down. And part of the reason has to do with the ballad that was written, and part of the myth is that she sang this ballad from the scaffold. Well, she did not do that. It was written, we know now, it was written by a schoolteacher in Morganton and handed out at the hanging. I think he may have actually sold it at the hanging. But in that ballad has come down word for word, and in there she tells what an awful thing she's done and how she's going to be punished in hell. And that has as much to do with it as anything.
This was made up.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it was actually, he took a Kentucky murder ballad and just changed he to she.
So it got grafted onto the Frankie Silver story, and we take it as truth now, as a part of the story.
Well, it was written down. It was published in a lot of the newspapers published it, and so that's what survived. The letters which I saw in the governor's paper, 17 of them, did not survive. And, of course, there were no court minutes, unfortunately, so we don't know what went on. We have two or three letters from her lawyer saying what his case was always that she should have been tried for manslaughter and nothing more serious. And the punishment for manslaughter at that time was a branded M on the palm of your hand.
The people who were writing letters then believed that she had killed him in self-defense, that he was attacking her, and that she, as you said earlier, she had better aim.
Yeah. Well, he was loading his gun to kill her. He had told her he was going to kill her. She wrote out a detailed confession, which we have never found. And the but these letters, these petitions to save her, refer to this confession, and they quote from it, and they say that he was loading his gun to shoot her, and she picked up an axe to defend herself. And I think that's
you
true.
You think that's the truth.
Yeah.
Well, Perry Dean Young is the expert on the Frankie Silver story. He's telling it to us. He's going to be telling it on television sometime soon, and we'll talk about all that after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Perry Dean Young is my guest. We're talking about Frankie Silver and the Frankie Silver stories. In addition to the story of the young wife who killed her husband with an axe and then had to be and was hanged for it, there are stories around the stories. And during the break, Perry Dean, you were telling me that you had some communication with one of the most famous North Carolinian, Senator Sam Ervin, about this story.
Well, Senator Sam Ervin, of course, was a lawyer, and so was his father. And Sam Ervin was born in Morganton, where Frankie was hanged, not that far away from where she was hanged. So he grew up hearing the story, too. But I was writing an article for Ms. Magazine about Frankie in 1973. And in September, the whole world was focused on the Watergate hearings, and Sam Ervin was at the very heart of that. But he took time out. He said, "Perry, I have been so busy, I'm really sorry I didn't get back to your letter." But he answered me in elaborate detail that, yes, he agreed with me that if she had ever been able to take the stand, she would never have been hanged if she could have proved that she killed the man in self-defense. And he said, "My daddy told me that the clerk of court, Burgess Gaither, told him that if she'd ever been able to take the stand, she would have been acquitted." Now, the interesting thing, one of these petitions is signed by the clerk of court.
This is a petition?
The petition to pardon her, to the governor to pardon her. For some reason, Governor David Lowry Swain would not pardon her. And he wrote an explanation, but we've never been able to find that letter that he said why he wouldn't do it. But in the letter, I've lost my train of thought.
Well, in this letter that was seeking a pardon,
the people in Morganton, it was signed by just about every lawyer in town. It was also signed by the sheriff, the jailer, and 9 of the 12 jurors. I don't know why those last 3 jurors held out, but they did. And I think that influenced the governor, too, by the way.
Well, this is you're getting back to the startling thing that Sam Ervin took time off from Watergate to write you a letter about Frankie Silver is kind of an interesting sidelight.
Well, he said, like you, I think history has dealt with her begrudgingly. And he was almost saying, you know, anything we can do to save this woman, never mind that she's been dead for 150 years, you know. But he was still very concerned about it. He had actually written an article himself back in the 1930s about how he thought she was innocent and how she should not have been hanged, you know. But the truth is, there will always be a question mark. But there have always been people who thought she was innocent. But if you go to every local newspaper in North Carolina, you will not find that side of the story. And a great victory for me is that the Discovery Channel, in their advanced publicity on this, is talking about the fact that she was an abused woman. And there seems to be no question about that. There were, believe it or not, there were 8 or 10 newspaper accounts of the murder itself, and then of the trial, and then of her hanging. And in there, every single one of them refers to him as a vagrant. Another one refers to him as a worthless
mocount. The deceased or the victim.
Yeah, they always say the deceased, or they use some proper word, and then they describe him as a worthless snow count. You know? And one of them even says that the fights were always started by him, that she had 2 years of nothing but fights and arguments with this guy. So the question of abuse, I don't think there is a question of that.
Oh, well, did you ever have a chance to talk personally with Senator Sam about it, or just you've got the correspondence?
No, we never met. We just corresponded. Yeah.
You mentioned the television program, and what have you're going to be a, you've talked to him, and you're going to be on camera or on my television screen about this. But as you talk to the people who are doing the television program about Frankie Silver, what have you learned that's new? What did they find out that you didn't know before?
Well, it was fascinating. A very bright young woman who had actually lived in North Carolina briefly, she was the producer, and she flew in from Los Angeles. The film crew itself came from Australia, believe it or not. And we did it up in Yancey County at a cousin of mine's house. And Lord knows how it's going to end up, you know, once they get through editing the thing. But it was like an interrogation. I mean, she had done her homework, but they told me that only one part of my face will be seen. Apparently, it's going to be very sinister. And I'm not sure I've provided all the lurid details, you know, that they wanted. But we went through the whole thing by detail. She interviewed two other people, by the way, who were going to give her the traditional story. And when we got to the end of it, she said, "What to you was the most shocking thing about this whole case?" And I'm sure that everybody else said, "Oh, the way she cut up his body, you know, well, he's dead. What the hell difference does that make, you know?" And I said, "The way this poor woman has been misrepresented for 150 years in North Carolina, it's a shame. It really is. I mean, there is another side of the story, but you won't read it in any of the newspapers." And I confess, I wrote some of those myself.
You know? What do you mean? When you were little, when you were young, you did.
When I was working for the Durham Herald, I wrote one and told it just the way that I now despise, you know. But after I found these letters and petitions that said, you know, that there's another side of the story, that she killed him in self-defense.
What do you think the reason is that modern-day people don't take the facts as you've gathered them, the evidence that you've got from the letters that were petition letters to the governor for pardon for, and the other records that seem to indicate that there was more to this than the traditional story?
I think they do. I think I helped turn the story around. I really believe that. One evidence of that is that Frankie's family, she had a daughter, a little baby daughter, and for generations they never talked about it. And now they have their own family reunion, and they're very proud of it. They talk about it. They have the website, and they talk about it now. Before, the Silver family had controlled the story. So it was always about poor Charlie being set upon by this evil woman, you know.
Well, those families aren't still up there, are they?
Oh, hell yeah.
The Silver family's there.
The house that Charlie was born in has never been bought, sold, mortgaged, or insured. It is still standing. And not the murder house, but the house where he was born.
Where he was born. This is where she, maybe where Frankie went to tell them
her husband was
missing.
Yeah, it's still there.
Does the family still own it?
Yes.
The last
I heard. Now, they could have sold it the last few years.
Part of the family, almost 200 years later, still has a stake in the victimhood of their kinsmen.
Some do, but there are also a number of very serious historians in the family. They have a big family reunion every year, and I was actually asked to speak. They had it in the Baptist church, and I said, "Well, I hope the walls don't come tumbling down on me. You know, my granddaddy wouldn't believe me. I'm standing in the pulpit of a Baptist church." But they invited me to speak, and the reason they invited me to speak is they wanted to hear the other side. And they're very serious about getting the facts right, to their credit, I think.
Well, the daughter, who's would be a descendant of both the murderer or the person who killed Charlie—that's Frankie—and then also Charlie. She comes out of both families,
right?
And where does her where do her children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, great-great-great-grandchildren, does she got descendants that are part of this too?
Hundreds of them, yeah. And as I said, for several generations, they didn't talk about it, you know. But now they do, and now they have their own reunion. Now they have, and interesting enough, there are several of the descendants named Charlie, but none of the women were named Frances, for Frankie. Yeah.
We're visiting with Perry Dean Young. We're talking about the story of Frankie Silver, the mountain woman who in 1831 killed her husband with an axe and has become a part of mountain and North Carolina legends. We'll continue our discussion after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Perry Dean Young and I are talking about, Frankie Silver and her murder of her, or her killing of her husband, Charlie, and Perry Dean's lifelong pursuit of this story to flesh it out, to share it with people. He's written a book about it, written a play about it, and now he's going to be part of a Discovery Channel program on Frankie Silver. And, you know, I mean, did you not have any fun working with these TV people? I mean, were you surprised by them? You said that the person who interviewed you was well-informed.
Well, she was deadly serious, too. I mean, they only had so much time. They were driving through North Carolina, and they had other people to interview and all that. That's part of the reason. But also, she was deadly serious about the subject. And she got me in the I've never seen—
Was she adversarial, or was she— sympathetic about this woman who had been abused
by her
husband?
No, she let me tell the story, her questions were very sharp. It was like a lawyer. It was like the interrogatory that they do before a trial, you know, where they just grill the hell out of you. And she
and
did.
What did she want to know? What was it that she wanted to know?
She wanted details, I think, and that's why I'm a little worried about how they're going to edit this thing because who knows what they're going to pick up on. But the heartening thing is that finally, after all these years of Frankie being portrayed as this evil villain, they're portraying her as an abused woman. That's a major victory.
Are you sure?
Absolutely. No, their advanced publicity says that. So, no, I'm not sure. I haven't seen the shows.
Well, but you mentioned that they are also given the opportunity for people who tell the
other story.
Traditional side of the story in which she's an evil person who plotted to do this. They're going to destroy that story. They're going to tell that story, but you think they're going to come down on your side.
I hope so. What control do I have? None, unfortunately. I would tell it, though. But I tell you something. The woman in charge of the family violence prevention program in Yancey County has invited me to do a program next month. And she seized on this story. She said, no, this not only shows, how a victim has been misrepresented. It's how the Charlie has always been portrayed as the victim, obviously, because lost his head. But she said the real victim was Frankie because she's been portrayed as a villain all these years. And the way people tell these stories, the wife is always the villain, you know, no matter what the circumstances. And she was fascinated by the way the story had been told all these years. And that's why I think the way we did our play, the way I did my book, and now the way I think they're going to do it on the Discovery Channel. But their advanced publicity says that we think of spousal abuse as something in our century, but it goes back as far as human relations go back. You know?
One of the things that gives power to the traditional story is the fact that there's this woman who's a scoundrel, you know, who's bad, who's evil. And that adds a dramatic touch to it that is taken away by your version of the story in which she is justified in this kind of reaction because she's simply trying to prevent her husband from killing her, she kills him in defense. And that's a nice story, but the real story that grabs you is this evil woman plotting to kill her husband. And so you know the story may die out if your version is
No, I don't think so. No, and frankly, I disagree with you because I think it's even more dramatic when she didn't do what they said she did and she wasn't able to tell her story, but she was hanged anyhow. I think that's much more dramatic, you know. And the people in Morganton also felt that way because, you know, hundreds of them, probably the population of the county, signed those petitions, 200 or 300 people. And all of her neighbors signed a petition. I mean, all of the people she knew up there.
You mentioned earlier that the not only townspeople, but I think you said 9 out of the 12 jurors also signed the petition asking for her to be pardoned, and the sheriff. And it wasn't just a few kooks who did this. They sent this petition to the governor, who's also a mountain guy. And he didn't act on it. And you said that he'd written a defense, but you can't – we haven't seen it. I mean, that he'd explained why he didn't do it.
He wrote a letter to the lawyer, to Frankie's lawyer, saying in detail why he was not going to pardon her.
Why do you – but we don't know – we haven't seen that letter.
There is no indication in the cover letter. He also – the women in Morganton, all of whom he knew, sent a last-minute appeal to him. And this was quite brave of the women because, you know, they had no rights, you know. But they appealed to him mainly because they did know him personally. You know, I mean, they were the high society in Morganton. And he claimed he didn't get it in time. Well, I looked up the records for the stagecoach from Morganton to Salem Town to Raleigh. And it was 2 days. And the letter... He had a whole week to answer. I mean, he had plenty of time to answer, but he claimed he didn't get it in time to
speculate about, or if you know some facts about why, what would David Swain, what could he say in justification for not giving the pardon?
I think the fact that only nine of the jurors, that's a majority, but nine of the, you know, justice had been done, you know, the law had been followed to the letter, and I think he just was a strict constructionist or whatever you call that, who said, no, I'm not going to overturn you. We've already had a trial. She had a trial, and a jury of her male peers has decided she's guilty and she should hang. You know?
So you think part of the story is, although David Swain's a hero in Chapel Hill and as governor of North Carolina— you're not too happy with him for letting this girl, this young woman.
Well, I'd love to know what his reasoning was. Yeah. His great granddaughter came to the play and was mortified that he turned out to be such a villain in my play because he was just amused that the women would try to get him to do something, to take something, and I think he probably was. I mean, the women didn't do anything at that time. But no, I'd love to know why he didn't do it, and I'm still looking for that letter where he explained why he didn't do it. I mean, a dozen different lawyers wrote to him and said, "Look, you know, here are the facts," you know, and he still wouldn't do it. But I think it was probably that he just said, "No, we followed the law, and we're not going to change it." But the previous governor had a reputation for being too lenient. That was Montford Stokes, but he, in the middle of this. After Frankie was, the first set of letters are to him, and then he got named to the Indian Territory in what is now Arkansas and Oklahoma. And he died out there, but he was governor of North Carolina. And he had a reputation, and he pardoned a dozen different people, including two women. One had the interesting name Sally Barneycastle. She was from Charlotte, and she had killed her child. It was infanticide. Apparently a fairly common crime back then, as appalling as it sounds. And he had pardoned two women who had killed their children. So he had a reputation for being too lenient.
Well, is there anything left on this story for you to find out? What are you looking, what
Well, Frankie's confession, David Sloane's letter explaining why he wouldn't pardon her, and Frankie's confession as to what really happened, you know.
But
we'll never know for sure, because there were only two people in that room, and one of them got his head cut off, and the other one lived to tell the tale, you know.
So there's no other place to look. I mean, you haven't got any ideas about where you're going to find out some of these missing facts.
Well, you know, I've been reading original documents since I was about 10 or 11 years old. In fact, in those days, you didn't have Xerox. You had photocopy, which was very expensive. But the Register of Deeds in Asheville was so impressed that a kid my age, I couldn't even drive. I was 12, 13 years old. I would come in with these original Civil War letters and things like that. He'd copy them for free, you know, photostat. And it amazes me constantly what you're always turning up.
Keep working on this story, and whether you find out anything new or not, come back and keep sharing with us. And congratulations on the Discovery Channel's.
Well, I like to think Frankie lives no matter what happened 150 years ago. She's still alive.
Thanks to Perry Dean Young. Keep a lookout for the television program that will feature him on the story of Frankie Silver. In the meantime, thanks for listening to Who's Talking. It's D.G. Martin. I'll be back here before you know it.